Welcome to the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. I'm your host, Alex Baker. In this episode, we are going back to the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, for the fifth time and look at his 1951 classic, Strangers on a Train. This film ranks among one of Hitchcock's best. Returning on the Armchair Directors to talk about Strangers on a Train and Alfred Hitchcock is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It was good having you.
I beg your pardon. Aren't you Guy Haines? My name is Bruno. Bruno Antony.
So yeah, this film relates a bit of my fear of annoying passengers for me, just because whenever I'm like on a plane or going on a bus or wherever, I always make sure to have a book or an MP3 player in hand so I never have to talk to people, because I just feel that one, you know, you're just going to get stuck to one of those people like a Bruno who just don't shut up and just tell you too much about their personal life.
I think he even addresses that in the film. He says something about how, you know, I'm not going to bother you because I know that you're famous, and then he proceeds to bother him.
It's a bit like the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Like, yeah, trust me, one guy I can't stand is the people who just keep talking. You know, they just keep talking.
They just keep talking and talking.
So what's interesting about this film, it feels a bit like a film. It feels the most film noir of any Hitchcock film to me. I mean, you have the femme fatale a bit, even though she doesn't play that much in the movie. She's gone really quickly. But there's a lot of use of shadows, and you see the main character fall into a pit of, you know, trouble and despair that he just can't get out of. And it feels very film noir-ish to me.
It does do a lot with the light and dark.
Mm-hmm, yes.
That is one of his motifs in the film, is that he contrasts Farley Granger's goodness in character with his secret desires, which Bruno embodies.
Yeah, and I was reading that it's sort of like a double, like, you know, he wished, you know, Bruno was like the other, like another person of him, the one that would get rid of his wife, you know, and kill her.
Well, there's all kinds of doubling in the movie. There's opposing forces of dark and light, good and evil, innocence and guilt all coming together. Hitchcock shows how the psychopathic murderer is the shadow of the innocent tennis pro in a lot of his shots. But the doubling is one of the most interesting things about the movie, and it's not in the book that it's taken from. But there are two taxi cabs, two red caps, two pairs of feet, two sets of train rails that cross twice. Once on the train, Walker's character orders a pair of double drinks, the only kind of doubles I play, he says. Hitchcock's cameo is getting on the train carrying a double bass, and there are two Hitchcocks in the movie, mm-hmm, because there's Hitchcock's cameo and his daughter, Patricia Hitchcock. There are two respectable and influential fathers, two women with glasses, two women at a party who like thinking of ways of committing the perfect crime, two sets of detectives in two cities, two little boys at two trips to the fairground, two old men at the carousel, two boyfriends accompanying Marion as she's about to be murdered. There's just doubling all over the place. And also in the way it's shot, because Hitchcock carries the theme into the editing, cross-cutting between Guy and Bruno with words and gestures. One asks the time, and the other one miles away looks at his watch. One says in anger, "I could strangle her," and the other far distant makes a choking gesture.
Yeah. Like I said, this film feels a bit like a film noir to me. I was curious, do you feel that any other films in his filmography that's like feel like a film noir? I think a close one to me would be Vertigo.
I think Shadow of a Doubt is a really good example of a film noir, because it's also black and white. It also deals with the undercurrent of evil that's embodied in Uncle Charlie. The opening scene starts off with, you know, flying inside the window, and you see the character laying on the bed just sort of pondering while he's smoking. Very cynical, very dark, very film noir.
Yes, very. So, you know, it's interesting. I was reading this. It was based on a novel. It was the very first novel by Patricia Highsmith. And, you know, she's also best known for her The Talented Mr. Ripley series. And we talk about these films like they're really old, but, you know, she's just been recently, the film Carol, I believe, was based off one of her novels.
That's right. And I think Carol is based on elements of her real life as well. You know, it's interesting because I think if Hitchcock had lived, he would have done a great job with those Ripley books. The whole character that is very crafty, the ordinary man who makes himself into something else, who reinvents himself. I mean, that's just classic Hitchcock stuff. But they did change some things about the book. There is no character that Patricia Hitchcock is playing in the movie. There's no tennis match. The cigarette lighter, the tunnel of love, Miriam's eyeglasses, these were all things added to the book. Also, she was not happy that he kind of you know, diverged from the book, because in the book, Guy does kill Bruno's father.
The book, okay.
He actually does go through with it. Of course, Hitchcock had to deal with the censors, and Patricia Highsmith did not.
And so I was wondering, in the book, was there that big chase at the end with the carousel?
There is a... They do refer to the amusement park, but very briefly. The merry-go-round scene isn't in the book. It's taken from the climax of a book by Edmund Crispin, a 1946 novel, The Moving Toy Shop. All the major elements of the scene, the two men struggling, the accidentally shot attendant, the out-of-control merry-go-round, crawling under the moving merry-go-round to disable it, they're all present in Crispin's book, but he didn't receive any screen credit for it.
And so I'm off to ask you, so would you say that you enjoyed the book better than the movie, or are they about the same, or one's better than the other?
I think they're really very different. I like Patricia Highsmith's books very much because she does a really good job with making a evil character prevail in a way, which most people, you know, they don't really want to go there with that sort of an idea. And I think Hitchcock liked that idea and did it as much as he could in his movies before he ran into the problems with the censors. Now, Raymond Chandler's second draft script, the final shot is Guy Haines institutionalized, bound in a straitjacket. And they didn't go with that one, but it is almost the way Psycho was going to end years later.
You'll see the fly on the wall or
something.
Yes. So, you know, speaking of Chandler, that's going to lead me right into my next question. I'm a big fan of Chandler, but I was just reading that him and Hitchcock really did not get along very well at all in this movie.
Yes, apparently Hitchcock was not pleased with his writing at all. Hitchcock ceremoniously dropped it into the wastebasket while daintily holding his nose. So he was apparently not very impressed with Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, and I'll have to tell a little story. Because Chandler hated Hitchcock as well, apparently, and when they were supposed to meet, and Chandler sees Hitchcock get out of a car, and he remarks very loudly so Hitchcock could hear, pardon my language, but look at that fat bastard get out of the car.
Unforgivable.
And I understand after, because Chandler really didn't do much. Like, most of what you see in the movie wasn't his, but he still gets the credit. So I understand Whitfield Cook, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Senesny Ormond, it was Hitchcock's assistant. They really wrote the screenplay, and most of what you see is from their contribution.
Which happened a lot with Hitchcock's movies. He always had a lot of people helping him with the script. His wife, Alma Reville, for example, she had a lot to do with almost every single script. But if you're going to be working with Raymond Chandler, you have to give him the credit because he was so famous.
Yeah.
You still wanted the name, even if you were going to rewrite everything he did.
Yeah. Chandler did not get along well with Hollywood, because I know his very first film in Hollywood was Double Indemnity, and him and Wilder, kind of the same thing, really did not get along well with each other.
Although that turned out to be a pretty good movie, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then Wilder did A Lost Weekend, and that whole character is supposed to be based off Chandler.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what I read, because Chandler was a huge alcoholic.
Okay, well, there's a lot of alcoholic problems in the movies.
So when we talk about Farley Granger, I think, next question, Farley Granger, you know, the two things I usually talk about when his movies is the two Hitchcocks, this film and Rope. And I thought he did, you know, I really liked his work in this movie.
I do, too. I think he's much better suited for this role than the role he plays in Rope. And it's interesting you mentioned Rope, because Hitchcock really needed Strangers on a Train to be a hit. He'd come off of Notorious in 1946, which was really well received. And then the next four movies kind of bombed. The Paradigm Case, Rope, although that got more acclaim later, Under Capricorn, and Stage Fright. So he really needed this movie to be a big hit, and it was.
And so I was curious about Farley Granger's career. I've seen a few of his films outside of Hitchcock. One film, if you've seen, I'll be really impressed. It was a spaghetti western comedy called My Name is Trinity.
I have not seen that one, but I have seen him in other film noirs.
It was what, They Lived by Night?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen that one. Another one was called Side Street. Yeah, and I think that's it for me.
Yeah, he's good in this role, though, because he plays a kind of weak-willed character. Mm-hmm. And but with a little bit of stage presence. I mean, he does embody the role very well. As you can see that he has the elements of Bruno in the background. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't want to admit it.
Yeah, and he does kind of carry that bit of nervousness and scaredness that you saw his character in A Rope.
Right.
And so then the other performance I really liked was Robert Walker, and he has Bruno, and it's really sad. I was reading about him. He died like right after this film was made, and he was only like 32 when he passed.
Yeah, he's an interesting story, because he started off as kind of boy next door roles. And often as a World War II soldier. And one of those roles was opposite his first wife, Jennifer Jones, in Since You Went Away. Mm-hmm. And that marriage broke up very acrimoniously, and he never got over it. He actually spent time at the Menninger Clinic in 1949, where he was treated for a psychiatric disorder. And right after that, right after he was released, he was cast in Strangers on a Train. Farley Granger has been in interviews where he said that Robert Walker was very, very needy and would call him all the time at all hours and want him to hang out with him and be with him and be his friend and all of these things. And he felt very inadequate to, you know, give the guy what he needed. Hmm. And then, of course, after he passed, he just felt terrible about it. The guy was just so damaged. Mm. But he does a great job playing a really psychiatric study in evil.
Mm-hmm. I saw a little bit of, I guess what it's called, homosexual subtext in the film. I feel that Bruno is really desperate to be liked by Guy. And he even says that he would do anything for him. So I was wondering, do you see a little bit of that subtext in the movie?
I do, and you can see it a little bit more in the British version, because the first encounter between Bruno and Guy on the train is longer and features a more obvious homoerotic flirtation by Bruno.
Hmm. And so, going back to performances, are there any performances that stand out? I think one performance, as we talked about earlier, was Patricia Hitchcock, and I thought she was really funny in this role, and she kind of added some dark humor to the movie.
She had some dark humor, she has some funny lines, and she also gets to sort of be the doppelganger to Miriam. She's the other girl with the glasses, she's the good one where Miriam's the bad one, mm-hmm. and she, she just adds a little bit of freshness and interest. The other role I really like in here is Leo G. Carroll, because he's mm-hmm. in so many of Hitchcock's movies. He's been in 6 movies for Hitchcock: Rebecca, Suspicion, Spellbound, The Paradigm Case, and Strangers on a Train, and North by Northwest. So you get to see him all the time in these sort of authority figures. He always seems to play a professor or a doctor or a senator.
Yeah, looking him up, I think he was also in the Man from U.N.C.L.E. TV show.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it was funny because I think I caught a little couple of funny lines from him. It's when he's hearing about the cops tailing him, and he goes, "Well, are they gonna be looking at my office?" And he was like, "Maybe." And he was like, "Well, my boy, you should probably just stay home for your own personal sake, of course."
There's also some joke that Patricia Hitchcock makes to him about, daddy's a senator, he's used to scandal.
And when Bruno faints after strangling the woman, he goes, "This fine thing, this will look in the press paper." Press papers. Next thing you know, they're going to be talking about orgies.
Yes.
So, we talk about Hitchcock in the 1950s, and you think of music, you usually think of, Bernard Herrmann. But this was just a little bit before he started that collaboration. This was with Dmitri Tiomkin, who, of course, was a big composer at that time.
Yes, and he had done work with Hitchcock on Shadow of a Doubt, and then he would go on to do I Confess and Dial M for Murder. But he and Hitchcock never really clicked. Hmm. Which is surprising because he's a terrific director and he does some really interesting things in this movie. He has a sort of a doubling effect going on in the music. The opening scene has this gruff bass motif set against Gershwin-like riffs. It's a two-part medley called Strangers and Walking that are never heard from again. For Guy's theme, Tiomkin created a hesitant, passive sound made to order for Farley Granger's performance. But with Bruno, he gets a more vigorous musical treatment. Harmonic complexity with motifs associated with Bruno include rumbling bass, shocking clusters, and glassy string harmonics. These disturbing sounds help you kind of understand the kind of cognitive dissonance that Bruno has. And then, of course, there's the Calliope music, which is, I think, what people really think about when they think about Strangers on a Train.
The carnival music.
The characters on the merry-go-round early on singing The Band Played On. Because after that scene ends, that music keeps reprising. Mm-hmm. You have it almost as Bruno taking it as advice. The band played on and he's going to keep doing what he's going to do. And you have that music repeat when they go into the tunnel of love and then when he murders Miriam. So that music is a motif as well and an idea.
Yeah, and I think I also noticed when he goes back to place the lighter at the island, I think once guy shows up and the police show up and it starts the showdown, you even hear that music start playing again.
Yes, that's the music that's playing when the guy gets shot and the lever gets pressed and everything gets sped up really fast. It becomes that music really, really fast.
Yeah, I was wondering if you picked up on this at the carnival, and maybe I'm just seeing, I mean, not quite seeing it like this, but you know, you see the balloons and then you also see the blind man. And I was wondering if that was a little bit of an homage to M.
That's a very interesting connection. I had not made that before.
Because that was one thing I was like, maybe that it's a little bit of an M homage, but you know, and I really, you know, we talked about it earlier. I thought the editing in this film was really good because, like you were talking, it shows the use of the doubles, you know, with both one character checking the time, and it cuts to Bruno checking the time as well. And then when Guy is, you know, angry on the phone, like, I could just strangle her. And then you have Bruno's hands, you know, in a strangling position. And I thought the editing was by Williams H. Zeigler, and I think he won a few Academy Awards for his work. And I thought he was really good in this film.
It's also useful that Hitchcock used certain conventions. He always used the convention that the left side of the screen is for evil and for weaker characters, while the right is for characters are either good or temporarily dominant. So if you think of the scene where Guy returns home to his DC apartment and Bruno's lurking across the street, Bruno has just killed Miriam that evening in Metcalf and has her glasses. On one side of the street are these stately, respectable houses towering in the background. On the right of the screen, the floodlit dome of the U.S. Capitol, the world that Guy aspires to. And then on the left side, there is this darkness. He actually has to step into the shadows to talk to Bruno and behind some iron bars.
Yeah, yeah. I was about to say that. And that leads also to the cinematography, which I also thought was really good. And I know the main shot everybody talks about is the glasses shot, when it focuses on the glasses and you can see Guy struggling. Bruno struggling Guy's wife.
Yes, it's that's just such a great scene because it allows him to use the glasses to make it look, so you don't have to look directly at it. You're looking at it a little bit distorted, but it's all very ominous. It's made more ominous by being looked at through the glasses, which are also broken. There's also some cross-cutting between Guy playing tennis in the sunshine and then Bruno's arm reaching into the gutter, like literally into the sewer to try to retrieve the dropped lighter. Interesting uses of going back and forth
light
between
and dark.
Good and bad and light and dark, both sides of the same person in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But about the glasses, for Hitchcock, glasses represent repression or transformation. So if you think about Lena on the train in Suspicion, in the beginning she's wearing these glasses. She's this schoolmarm looking person. In Spellbound, Ingrid Bergman, before she falls in love, is wearing glasses. And of course, in Strangers on a Train, Pat Hitchcock and Guy's wife both wear glasses. And finally, in Vertigo, Barbara Bel Geddi's character, you know, is wearing these glasses. All of these characters are either repressed or about to transform into something else. So he uses the glasses in those ways, in interesting ways.
Yeah, no, then that painting in Vertigo when she does the kind of joke painting, and he gets really upset with her when he does that.
Yes, and it's obviously, you know, it's a very good picture actually of herself.
Yeah, and we were going back to a little bit about the cinematography by Robert Burks. I was looking him up, and he's, for the most part, he's done the cinematography for all of Hitchcock's films. So I would have to say he played a big part in, I think, Hitchcock being the, you know, the legend that he is.
I would agree, and he adds a certain look to Hitchcock's movies that I think is well known.
Mm-hmm. And I was curious, did he work with Hitchcock on his TV show in any of them?
I don't know. That's a really good question.
Okay. So, you know, this film was in 1951, and do you feel that this film helped kick off the golden age of Hitchcock, you know, when we would see, you know, Rear Window and then Vertigo and then North by Northwest?
I think I would say yes, because the movies that came after, I think, were his best period when he really sort of found his way after that string of flops. Mm-hmm. I think he sort of got back with this movie and went on to make some of his best.
And the one thing I noticed was, I'm not that extremely familiar with studios, but I noticed he did this with Warner Brothers, and I believe in the later on in the 50s, didn't he move away from Warner Brothers and use another studio?
He did use other studios. He made his way through most of the studios, I think. I'm not sure how much I would say Warner Brothers did for him in terms of his career. Mm-hmm. He certainly seemed to do his best work with some of the best studios, but not always.
Yeah. It's kind of like a lot of great directors. They can just choose whoever studio they want, and the studios will be like, oh, we'll have you, you know.
As long as they let you work with the people that you want to work with, then you're fine. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much pressure they put on him to work with Raymond Chandler, for example. You know, I mean, that could have been a studio, mm-hmm. A studio must. I mean, there's lots of examples of him having to do things because the studio wanted him to that he didn't really want to go along with. He famously did not get along with David O. Selznick.
Oh, yeah, because when we're talking about Rear Window, didn't you say Thorwald was kind of a reflection
modeled after
of him?
Yeah, yes, yeah. And with the glasses. He even picked the same glasses.
Wonder what O. Selznick thought. It's like, oh, geez, I'm modeled after a serial killer now.
He was an egomaniac, so he probably thought it was flattering.
So, you know, you did see this film's influence on later work, and sometimes it was for humor. There was that Danny DeVito film, Throw Mama from the Train, and I'm not a huge fan of CSI, but I know they did a whole episode dedicated to Hitchcock, and the whole episode was a murder kind of based on these ideas where, like, two women did get together and pull off this exact idea of crime.
Yes, it's a famous idea that's been reprised several times in radio programs and in TV movies and a recent movie called Horrible Bosses.
Oh, yeah.
Which takes that theme and runs with it, too.
Yeah, and that's going to lead into my next question. I'll admit I have some very mixed feelings about this because I heard it's an upcoming remake. They're going to do a modern update of Strangers on a Train, and that sounds, you know, that doesn't sound very good. However, it is directed by David Fincher, and Fincher's done amazing films like Fight Club, Zodiac, Seven. He's done a lot of great movies. And it's going to be written by Gillian Flynn. She wrote Gone Girl, and it's going to be starring Affleck, who was also in Gone Girl, and Fincher directed Gone Girl. So it could be good. But I just don't see why you have to do a remake.
I never understand why you have to do a remake, especially if something that is done really well. But one thing that might be good is if they do remake it, if they go with the original plot and have Guy actually do Bruno's murder, they might be able to play with that in a way that hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
So let's hope for that.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, Fincher, I would probably say, is one of the best directors like out there right now, in my opinion. And I think any other director, I would say it'd be bad, but with him, it might be good.
It might be good.
Yeah. So we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I haven't talked about or covered that you want to bring up now that we can talk about?
There are two things. One is the influence on Carol Burnett's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. In the 50s, a young Carol Burnett was working as an usherette when the theater was showing Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train, and she really loved it. So she'd already seen it, and she advised two people arriving during the last 10 minutes to wait until the next show so that they wouldn't miss all of the buildup. And her boss fired her on the spot. So later, when the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce offered her a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, they asked her where she wanted it, and she said, right in front of where the old Warner Brothers Theater was at Hollywood and Wilcox, which is where it was placed. The other thing that is a nice bit of trivia to know is that Hitchcock and his daughter were both terrified of heights. So Hitchcock offered Pat Hitchcock $100 to ride the Ferris wheel, only to order the power cut, leaving her in the dark at the very top of the ride.
Oh, no.
Now, the press release embellished the story, saying that he left her there dangling in total darkness for an hour, only then allowing her to be lowered and released. But Pat Hitchcock says that's not really what happened, that she was not up there alone. She was up there with the two guys who play the two guys taking Miriam on a date. Mm-hmm. And they were laughing and waving, and they have pictures of this. And she was not left up there for a long time either. It was just good stuff to leak to the press to make it seem like, bolster Hitchcock's sadism.
Yeah.
You know, she says, no, we were only up there 2 or 3 minutes. My father wasn't ever sadistic. The only sadistic part was I never got the $100.
That's funny. That's a good one. So, okay, then, last question I have for you is tell us a little bit about the classes you teach. I know you said that you have a Hitchcock class, but you're not going to be teaching that for a little while.
I do have a Hitchcock class. I taught it in fall of 2015, so I will be offering it again in fall of 2017. I also teach world cinema every semester and American cinema every semester, And this upcoming fall, 2016, I will be teaching film and philosophy with Helen Mitchell and French film.
Ooh, good. Well, just curious. I like a French film. So you'll be talking about like Godard and Melville, one of those?
We will be talking about all the old classics, but also the new upcoming directors, movies, actors, actresses, screenwriters, everyone involved in French film.
All right. Sounds awesome. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. Once again, we have been talking about the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, and his 1951 classic, Strangers on a Train. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure having you. For The Armchair Directors, I'm Alex Baker, saying, I beg your pardon, but aren't you Guy Haines?
So savage, Guy.
Sure, I sound savage. I feel savage. I like to break a neck.